Good afternoon, and many other good afternoons to different parts of the world. We're back with our Lena Life show. I'm Lena Mirmond with Julian Lampert. And we're totally having a spontaneous show because indeed we changed our plans so rapidly that I didn't even realize that we changed them. How silly that can be sound. But I'm glad that we are with the air, with the waves, with the thoughts, ideas. And for change, I will introduce Julian Lampert as a leader of this show, just throwing at him a few moments of thoughts, and perhaps he will form the questions. And I will answer them the best way I can. Julian, what is in your mind and what is about today and perhaps about tonight's debates and, of course, many other thoughts and ideas? Just display this in front of all of us.
Well, it's great to be here with all of you this evening. We're having on the East Coast some beautiful weather. It's definitely feeling like fall, with a bit of some reminders of what our summer was like. And I'm very excited about tonight's second presidential debate. I think that, as with all debates, we have to be very careful to not be in the danger of sensationalizing a mistake or sensationalizing something that went right, and to jump to a conclusion that one moment can automatically change the direction of the whole presidential election in these debates. Certainly that's very much the case when we look back in history, when there were certain critical moments, or maybe even a single moment, that set the tone for how things would play out, or the result of the results of pollings and taking a lot of opinions from a great many people. But it is fairly unusual, as far as I've been able to tell, where one candidate who was leading fairly substantially, which in this case we don't have in this case necessarily, but I'm just saying that in history, in past history, it's fairly unusual that we have one leading candidate who says something so catastrophically wrong as to give the other candidate basically the victory of the entire game. So the fact that President Obama didn't do as well as he could have last time, I don't think that necessarily means the end of his campaign, as many people in the media and frankly people in our communities would like us have to believe. So we should just be careful and look forward to a very healthy exchange of ideas tonight.
Well, you used the word healthy. Can I just take away for a moment all this political agenda with overwhelming content and positions, and just to speculate and see what you think regarding these two individuals as a human being, besides mounting amount of money close to $200 million, which cost the campaign, at least in one of the individuals, what kind of an emotional and human cost behind this amount of efforts? When one's start to think about just the pressure for the last, let's say, year or so, when all this agony of campaign has started, I cannot reject the idea that we sometimes need to think about human aura, because it becomes more and more challenging, at least the way I see it, to remain a human. And the only way to pull through physically through this, as I said, agony of running, one needs to become almost like a robot, almost competing with a computer who will not make any mistake as a calculator, but doesn't have the side effect of having a human nature, having this incredible, almost unthinkable challenge on the human psychology, nervous system, and all other aspects which a human needs to have, just physically and mentally to pull through this. Your thoughts as a young generation, to summarize the question, what do you think does it take? What do we see and what we don't see?
Well, that's a question I really am not sure how to answer, because it's something that doesn't have to just do with the election. It deals with any, that question has to do with, it has to do or should apply to any individual or any company that is struggling to be successful. We're living at a time when more than ever before, marketing and commercialism is dependent on success. And that's it's a very serious problem when you have a product or a service that is more dependent on the marketing to be successful than it is on the quality of the product.
Can I ask you interfere with one question and say, do you think it has to do with a lack of education, that people's minds are so reluctant to internalize, to be active participant, to do their mental intellectual homework, and therefore very vulnerable and needy in having this marketing power to explain to them, to let them know what's going on, sometimes to manipulate their minds, ultimately to make sure that they are following certain trend of the marketing rather following their own mental abilities.
Yes, absolutely. That's definitely the case. It's a very serious problem. The less educated a person is, the more vulnerable that person is to much more primitive forms of communication. And we have to be very careful here when we say not educated enough. We absolutely do not mean someone who did not necessarily get a college degree or even a high school degree. That's not what we mean by uneducated. What we mean by uneducated, much more so, is, yes, I would say that a minimum of a high school degree is critically important. But just as important as that, it's an education of dealing and working with people. That's the most important kind of education, and that's just and that's a really serious problem now, because we have a massive shortage of people who have reliable and solid communication skills, and we have to be able to reach those people so that they can vote. And it's actually a very scary situation to have to run a massive and super expensive marketing campaign to reach people who are really very, very poorly educated. So that's a big problem, and it's all the more a serious problem because on the other end of the extreme, we do have extremely educated people who are in the corporate workplace, corporate legal, and medical, but those are much fewer people in number than the people who are substantially less educated. So it's a huge challenge for these candidates to be able to reach this absolutely gigantic range of people. And I'm sure that must be one of the reasons why it's so incredibly expensive to market these campaigns, because you have to market them across gigantic, absolutely huge, enormous spans of geography, and making sure that all kinds of people will be reached by these campaigns.
I did not realize that we became so much involved with this topics, which I don't consider political, with Julian's very wide horizon of description of the issues. It's really quite a human issue. Before we will have our usual moments with music, which I personally enjoy immensely, always anticipating to dilute, not to diminish, but to dilute our intensely sometimes placed thoughts, I like to stretch to another idea regarding these campaigns and pick up on something which Julian said, and that has to do with unfortunate separation between an intellectual world and people who are dealing in everyday working place. I always was surprised that there is a huge gap between an intellectual elite and a business elite. And by elite, I do not mean some ivory tower existence. I truly believe that United States is concentration of one of the most powerful group of an intellectual elite. No one will argue with the fantastic amount and power of Ivy League schools, but even with the presence of some very special schools and in elementary level. So there is no shortage of that. But with these colossal changes, global changes which we experienced, I believe that gap became even wider. And when some politicians talking about division in the country, and they complaining that the country is divided because of the Washington's policies, I believe it goes even deeper. It goes deeper because, as I mentioned before, there is no really connection for a number of years between those different intellectual groups. There is no connection between an intellect and the working class. There is no much of the interaction there. How it can be changed, obviously, in one program, I'm not going to propose to be that smart and ambitious. But the one thing I can certainly say after teaching for more than 40 years, that if you have open mind, if you're thinking out of the box, if you allow students to meet some interesting people as a guest in their classrooms, if you certainly more tune into students' extracurricular interests besides sports, then you started to rebuild these connections and diversification in people's mind. And that's what Julian beautifully put together. It's a working with the people, it's a communication with the people, and a contact with the people. Did I say something in a correlation with what you said?
Yeah.
You did. Well, Julian politely agreed, but I see sincerity in his eyes, in his beautiful eyes. So with that, we're going into the music, after which we'll continue our conversation. This cascades of music thoughts and tremendous emotional energy, we're coming back to our cascades of thoughts. Julian, we stopped on your thought in terms of interaction between different people. I think it starts within the family. And that's where, not to sound overwhelmingly negative, but there is no secret. Inside of the family, not much of a communication. Tremendous stress, tremendous challenge to not only earn a living, but just to find the time to communicate. Your thoughts?
I totally agree. That's it's a serious crisis. I don't think really much... nothing really very new can be said about it, because it's such an old problem that is getting worse. There needs to be something which I remember President Clinton saying many years ago. He said that every single problem has been, every single problem in the U.S. has been solved by someone somewhere, and that it's, and he said that it's not a question of just finding the solutions to the problems, but it's actually much more of making those solutions part of the American system. That's where the problem is, and I so strongly agree with that statement, because we have many extraordinary teachers incredible teachers in places, many times in places we would never expect them, where we'd never expect to find them. We have many amazing examples of fantastic family structures, family units. And we really do have many of the solutions, I think, to the problems which America is struggling through. But there really needs to be a much more centralized attention, a centralized, I don't mean centralized in the socialist sense, of course not, obviously not, but just a much greater awareness of what are people doing in South Dakota that can be applied to New York City? What is being done correctly in Alaska that can also be applied to Southern California or New Mexico? We have such a giant country, and this country is so heavily focused on private enterprise that we have all of these different private organizations sprinkled everywhere, but I'm not really sure that they're communicating with each other effectively enough. So that's what I would like to see happen, is for the attention to our problems to be more, for there to be more awareness across the board, from Alaska to New England to every single state, for those problems to be more widely discussed together as a whole, and so that we can learn from what, that way we can learn more effectively what works and what doesn't work. The other thing that I would add is this is something I don't know historically enough about. I'm not a historian, but I think it's in my amateur view, I think it would be a very good idea if the job of president and maybe other government positions like senators, if those jobs would not pay people. And we have an amazing example with Mayor Bloomberg, who, of course, gets paid symbolically just $1 a year, but nothing more than that. He truly is extraordinary in that he is a totally selfless leader and politician. A man of his unbelievable wealth doesn't need to do any kind of work, much less be the mayor of probably what is the most difficult city in the Western world to in which to lead. And among Democrats and Republicans, he and independents, he carries really extraordinary universal respect. And I really have to wonder how positively our political system would be affected by this kind of radical change, by eliminating salaries from these positions, because then you, you're also, I think from what I can, from what I can gather in my thoughts, you're also eliminating some of the aggressive need for marketing and advertising that is necessary for the election, because there's just simply less less money is in the picture, and it's more truly much more about how qualified an individual is and not qualified.
Well, I have to ask you questions, because even though idea is quite seductive in humanitarian way, but just to understand, Mr. Bloomberg happened to be already independently wealthy man, but president doesn't need to subscribe to this status in order to be a president. So he has to eat and he has a family. So how he's going to survive?
That's exactly the point, that if the potential president or leader is already wealthy and doesn't need to work in order to sustain financial freedom, and in order to not just survive but just live very comfortably, that will enable him or her to all the more live entirely for this labor of love, being to lead, to govern, rather than have to be paid for. Because when we examine how many of the presidents were already quite wealthy when they led the country, I can't think of a president who was poor.
Honestly, you certainly know this better than myself and many others, even though you're very modest about this. But to the best of my memory, I would not say automatically that every president came well off and could govern just from his mind and the heart. I think some of them still need to have some kind of salary, and if they didn't need it, then they deserve it. That is certainly something which is permissible in your philosophy, to have a salary. So let me partly disagree with you, saying that in case if someone is not significantly well off and therefore would need some salary, but that should not be the main force to capitalize and to use it for marketing. It can be used for well done job, but not as a marketing tool, as you said, and I totally agree with that. Mm-hmm. So I would say that certainly system has its cavity, and a much more profound question, perhaps one time we will have conversation about this, it is connection of our modern quite changed world to the I would say classicism of constitution, and how those historic rules are surviving in today's society. That is really something I think very often, being an immigrant myself, and having that privilege to compare both worlds, the Eastern European world and America, all these modulations, all these changes are certainly bringing very, very new concept and practicality in everyday life. So I would ask you another question. How do you feel the role of the president today has changed? What do you think true challenge today as a part of a modern society? For example, the same situation which we're facing now literally in every country in the world. What do you think is inseparable between the president and today's world, which was not so relevant even 15, 20 years ago?
I think one of the main changes is that the president has to be very well aware of working with an international community, with other countries, because of globalization. And I don't think that that was irrelevant 15, 20 years ago. It was relevant back then as well. But it's much more of an issue today, just simply because of the signs of that, of what we're seeing. The financial crash around the world, how the American crash affected Europe. We saw an entire country, Iceland, go entirely bankrupt. And as far as I'm aware, there Iceland is doing a nice job rebuilding itself. That I would say is the main difference from today and the former periods. The president has to be more aware of the consequences of his decisions, not just consequences around the corner from his office, but how his decisions will affect the other side of the world. Who would have ever guessed before Barack Obama that we would have one country after the next in the Arab world, in the Middle East, having such radical turnarounds? It's just absolutely extraordinary. So that teaches us a lesson that we have to be prepared at all the time, absolutely all the time, for any kinds of changes to take place. And we will be much better prepared for those changes if we have close ties with our international friends and hopefully make some new international friends to everyone's advantage. So I'm painting a kind of idealistic world, but my point is that that leaders are now, not just America, but every single leader around the world faces a much bigger responsibility than before, which is a global responsibility, not just what happens under his soil.
If you do not mind, I will return a little bit to what you said earlier and point some contradiction, which I feel exists in our society today. Before I do this, I'd like you to think what the next piece of music we're going to listen to. And while you're making your choice, I'm going to address one thought which I found extremely relevant, very powerful, when you said that we're living in an absolutely huge, great country, and people should be much more aware and to have this diffusion and learning and communication between different parts of the country. And a contradiction which I mentioned is that we really have for all this digital mentality. Digital abilities, and then to capitalize and to use our mental abilities, indeed to reach out, to stretch out, to get that tremendous excitement of touching something which we don't know, because I cannot imagine more of the exciting and exotic revelation when you would say, my goodness, I never thought it could exist. And yet it's on the same roof of United States of America. We will continue on this note after this musical note, which in fact I like to tell the name of the piece.
We're going to hear an improvisation on an American classic, Amazing Grace.
amazing grace. Julian, do you mind if I will sustain that for a moment and will come back to the thought which I would keep in my mind? Talk a little bit of the memories. When you've been around 6 years old, you already improvised quite a bit. That particular little one little moment in this beautiful composition reminded me something which you improvised. I don't remember the name of the song, but I remember it was in C major, all white keys, but quite a bit filled with a lot of emotions. Do you remember when you started to improvise? Do you remember how did it feel to travel from key to key? Anything you can fill the air with your memories?
No, frankly, I don't remember. I just remember loving it very, very deeply. At that age, playing the piano was absolutely my favorite activity. That's the main memory I have, is how much I loved it. And to be able to have this at that age, it seemed to me like a giant instrument. It was like a toy, and I was completely addicted to that toy. And I also would get extremely excited when I would hear you practicing.
Wow.
And that's when I could hear how good this giant toy can really sound.
How nice of you to say this. But frankly, I was quite amazed with the variety of your improvisations at that time, even though it was only in white keys. In fact, white keys have been for quite a few years. Do you remember why?
No.
It's.
I wish I could give a logical explanation to that.
Because it was
C major. I wasn't even aware of what key what key I was in. Obviously, the pieces that I was learning that you were teaching me, that was very different because they were in many different keys. But I don't really know why I gravitated towards C major.
Well, it's, of course, for the little child, it's number one, it's a little easier to play just in the white keys. Black keys are a little deeper and a little narrower, so it's a little bit complicated. But it was hysterically funny because you already picked up a little piece of Liszt, I played Tchaikovsky, you played a few other pieces, and everyone was happy in C major because of you. With this, I'd like to transfer to our talk regarding your reaching out, you do not mind, reaching out with our thoughts, with our minds, and connecting different places different states for this indeed huge country. This is a tremendous contradiction in between abilities and that digital technology, which is literally under the tip of our fingers. We do not even need to leave our house or apartment to reach out just about any place, yet we are disconnected, yet we somewhat inert, yet we are not enough curious. We are under tremendous materialistic psychological pressure to perform, and obviously economic crisis pushes everyone to the maximum, but we still cannot forget to be a human being. In fact, if we forget, we're becoming extremely upset about this. It is a hidden statistic, but people's depression is escalating, and a drug company has just bringing more and more, I would say, semi-solution to that. And I only can imagine how many of those problems, if not solved, but will be smoothened and will be much more human and much more manageable if people indeed will use their curiosity, will use their desire to stretch to communicate, something which you've been talking about. I feel that syndication of the programs are a wonderful thing, but again, it's to make more money. It's not bring the quality of the information or exchange. I put a lot of ingredients in my thought, but I was very much captivated by your idea, how disconnected we are living in this country. Can you imagine how we disconnected, thinking what in another part of the world, and yet it's a global society? Your stage.
Well, I agree with everything you said. Before things, well, I think things are already starting to improve in that sense, in the communication, slowly, but it is starting to improve, and even though technology has contributed to the isolation, why does a farmer who has internet access, why does he necessarily have to venture out towards people if he has so much information at his fingertips, right? But on the other hand, because we are a social animal as a species, society obviously would collapse without that natural network of communication on just very basic human levels. So that's maybe more of an area for scientists and anthropologists. But I think that if we do use the economy as a measuring tool for how things are progressing in a general level, we, at least I would like to think that we are past a point in which things were much, much worse than they are now. And they were incredibly bad not really so long ago. So my bottom line idea is that we are getting better, but we have the pain, the very strong pain of this transformational process, we're still going to feel for a while before we start to see the kind of improvement across the board everywhere, and not just in the U.S., in the world. But it's going to be a while before, hopefully, some of the lessons that we're now learning are fully internalized. And I am extremely optimistic in the sense that I think we have enough people, good people, who do have enough control, enough influence, that there are enough of them to guide our world in a safer direction rather than in the direction that we were dangerously heading not so long ago. So, but we still have a very tough road ahead.
Certainly like to ask you a somewhat simple question about an instinct. You described so powerfully the process And I believe if I understood and grasped at least the major point, we're going through the selection. We're going through the process where something will be left behind by humanity and something will be brought up as a progress. So instinct wants to survive. And my theory is that in a very short, in a critically short historic period of time, so many things happened. I repeated this in my lectures and a number of times in my radio programs that was just a chain of powerful events, just to remind, to make my point a little bit more clearer. There was a collapse of communism. There was a rebirth of terrorism. There was tremendous consequences of a collapse of communism, where borders being literally not an issue anymore, and people just started to be in panic and mixed with countries which being much more prosperous. And it was just a colossal mess, to simplify this. So the instinct of survivability perhaps marked the force in Europe to unify itself, which is another not very simple historic phenomena to clarify. But the point is of instinct. And I'm so glad that you see that there is a progress and there is a light at the end of the tunnel. But let me ask you that question. Instinct always needs to be treasured and worshipped because it is a power of human survivability. How do you see the technology is on the way to this human instinct, and how do you see it's helping this human instinct?
You're asking how is it on the... You mean how it's an obstacle?
How it's an obstacle?
Instinct and
yes,
how it,
it's helping.
Helping.
Yeah.
Well, that's a really fundamental question. I think it was Einstein who said it, or it may have been someone else, but I think it was Einstein who said that any new technology is always going to have its extraordinary benefit and a complementary a terrible bad side to it as well, a dark side. And we don't need examples of the internet to show us examples of that. The technology has been incredible. The convenience is something that the world has never known. But we have internet security issues. We have hackers. We have this giant arena, this totally new territory of danger, which the world has only really seriously been facing for the last few years. So you're asking a complicated question. I think in the end, it is serving instinct more than it is an obstacle to it, because just simply because of the efficiency of how technology helps us get these very, very basic things done so much more quickly and more efficiently, it just makes life easier. We can breathe a little bit easier when we know that we have those certain critical letters already halfway across the world in an instant, rather than the stress of having to wait two, 3 weeks for the letter to reach the other side of the world by regular mail. Those kinds of conveniences at this point, it's almost silly how we take them for granted. medicine is another huge example, where we have X-rays that are now digital. We have a whole array of tests and diagnostic procedures that that are much, much easier on the patient and much less painful. They're also much, much faster. Procedures like colonoscopies, endoscopies, and a whole slew of procedures which now are done on general, if not general aesthetic, but not aesthetic, anesthesia, I should say general sedation. So these kinds of techniques really have made it so much easier on the public and on doctors. So there is no one is complaining about that kind of efficiency and convenience being obstacles. So I think, just as with all examples in history, we just have to get through that very, very difficult and painful phase of completing the cycle of evolution. The evolution being how these new technologies become internalized in our society. And that's something that we cannot rush. That's something that only time can determine. But I am very optimistic, and I keep going, I'm going back again to President Clinton. I remember during his campaign, presidential campaign, he said one wonderful phrase. He said that what is hurting in this country is not something that I don't remember his exact words, but it was something like that the things that are wrong in this country can be corrected by those things which are right in this country. So I think that can be used as a metaphor everywhere. We have more solutions than I think we realize, and we just have to stop the certain media hysteria. We have to step ourselves much further away from the commercialism and the marketing segments of our society, which are badly forcing us to think and believe in certain directions. And we have to step away from that and return to ourselves, return to our own judgments, and use the facts, use concrete results, which are right in front of our nose, in front of our eyes, and that's where the challenge is. I don't think the challenge is so much in finding the solutions. It's the biggest challenge is to it is first of all to be visible, to not be deaf and blind to those solutions because they're there, but also to systemize them in a way so that we can apply them to huge segments of our society.
One only can think. And I like to do just that. I think we will conclude with another wonderful piece of music, which I will let Julian to conclude our program. And I only want to add, if that would fit to your very remarkable thoughts about human process, Victor Borger used to say, if you learn something new, don't get nervous. And I think it's somewhat correlate with what you said, to come back to yourself and use our own power. On this note, which music we're going to listen?
Let's hear an anthem which I composed. An anthem that's not really dedicated to any particular cause, but it was just an anthem that was circulating in my mind, and I decided to write it down.
Was a final musical note to our program. That was Lena Life and Julian Lampert. And I'm Lena Miremont. Until next time, which I believe will be October 30th, with a very fine musician, Anna Kate, and her dramatic romanticism moved many hearts, and I'm sure it will move yours. Until then, I wish you all the best times with very special tonight's time with the debate, which might change the course of our country. Mm-hmm.